Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and once again, time for TWiT's audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It's only going to take a couple of minutes, really. That's all. Just go to twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. Your anonymous feedback will help us make TWiT even better. And thanks for your continued support.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Emery Roan, and Mike Keyes. Episode 373, recorded January 20th, 2017, The Krusty Krab Doctrine. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Audible. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/TWiL.
Hi, folks. Happy Inauguration Day. I'm Denise Howell, and you're tuning in for This Week in Law. We're joined by my former co-host, Sarah Pearson, this week. Great to have you back, Sarah.
Thanks, Denise. I'm so happy to be here.
So good to see you. It's been almost a year. I checked. You were on the show last March, I believe, last time. So I'm glad we were able to bring you in before that year expired. Sarah, for those of you who might be tuning in for the first time or somehow have missed Sarah in the past, is senior counsel with Creative Commons, which turned 15 just recently, right, Sarah?
That's right. Yep, in December.
That seems like a very fast 15 years to me, but congratulations. Were there festivities involved?
I think just online, because now we're all, we don't have an office anymore. We're all remote. We have our global summit coming up in April, so I'm sure we'll do something in person to celebrate then. But
that's great. Cool. Where's that going to be?
That's in Toronto this year.
Fun.
Yeah.
That will be fun. Great. Also joining us, who just chimed in, is Emery Roan, who is a third-year law student at California Western School of Law in San Diego. Hello, Emery.
Hey, Denise. Hey, Sarah. Hey, Mike. And hey, chat and listeners and viewers. It's, as always, a pleasure to be here. It's uncharacteristically but perhaps thematically appropriately rainy and gloomy day today, but we've got some interesting news to discuss, so I'm excited.
We do. It's been a really interesting week on a number of fronts, some of which having to do with Washington, some of which not. We hope to get to all of that in just a moment here. But first, I want to introduce my other co-host, Mike Keyes, who is a partner at Dorsey & Whitney in Seattle. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Denise. And hello, Emery and Sarah. Great to be with all of you.
Great to be back with you, too. All right. So I think we will, in honor of the momentous day that we are recording on, start out with some topics related to Washington, D.C., legislation, regulation, and policy. So it occurs to me as we kick off the show here that our new president, no longer president-elect, Donald Trump, probably just received the greatest ratings he has ever had in his entire television career. So kudos to the president for that. I thought it would be fun or interesting or, you know, a tech story related to policy that is sort of not probably high on everybody's radar today as we inaugurate the new president, but interesting nonetheless. Some people from the technology world industry, people that might be familiar to our viewers and listeners who are in D.C. and continuing to work in D.C. as the administration's shift over here. One of them is Matt Cutts. Matt Cutts was one of the original first 100 people at Google, long time in charge of search quality at Google. One of the pieces I read on him mentioned that he was the brains behind Google's Safe Search algorithm, which I've quibbled with in the past as I've raised my son, but in general, I'm very happy he's there. And he has announced that he has officially resigned from Google. He's been working in Washington with the U.S. Digital Service for some time And he announced recently that he is going to be staying on there. The U.S. Digital Service Office is pretty interesting and does a really important job. It seems to be the office in charge of making sure that government websites work well and are secure, and that the information that people put into them is secure. One of the things that Matt has worked on is, or a USDS project at any event, has involved incorporating two-factor authentication into verifying identity for the IRS, various really important projects. So it's good to know that Matt Cutts is in DC, at least I do think so. Although one of the pieces I read on this one in TechCrunch by Taylor Hatmaker ends on sort of the ominous note that as an Obama-era innovation, the USDS could easily find itself on President Trump's chopping block, although no plans have been specified at this time. So as far as we know for now, Matt Cutts is staying on as a technology knowledgeable person in DC, which I like to think is a good thing. Any comments from the Peanut Gallery on this? Sarah, any thoughts?
Not really. I thought the articles were interesting, especially from when they were talking about how inspirational Matt finds the work and how he felt like he was really doing something meaningful, even though he makes a lot less money than he did at Google and that sort of thing. I don't know. To me, I just found it kind of interesting, but I don't know Matt and don't know anything about the details, but.
Yeah, I don't know him personally either. He has definitely been on the conference circuit in the technology industry for quite some time, and he's just sort of a well-known figure. So, certainly a very smart person. So, I bring it up because it's nice to know for our purposes that there are people knowledgeable about tech and the way the tech industry works and the way actual technology works that are doing jobs, policy related jobs in Washington. So, Emery, any thoughts?
No, no, sorry. Much of what Sarah was saying, it sounds like a good thing, I guess, but I don't really have much of input.
Right.
Apparently Matt has been over on This Week in Google a few times, so he gets the Twig seal of approval.
Yes. This may be more something that you're paying attention to, Mike. That I think it was initially thought that the current director of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, Michelle Lee, a former attorney for Google, would step down as part of the changing of the guard in Washington. But apparently that is not happening. She did tender a letter of resignation to President Obama, which she has now revoked. And it appears she will stay on as head of the USPTO. And there is a lot of speculation. If you read the story in our discussion points at IP Watchdog, it sort of runs it down. There's coverage at The Hill about this as well, about the role of Peter Thiel in possibly keeping her on various meetings with Eric Schmidt and, you know, other tech leaders that have happened running up to the inauguration here. But this is all speculation. No one really knows how or why Michelle Lee is staying on, but it appears that she is. Do you want to chime in on that at all, Mike?
Yeah. So other than reading this story that was circulated earlier, I really don't know much about it. It is common, as I understand it, for head of agencies to submit letters of resignation. She apparently did submit one that was going to be effective at noon today. It was withdrawn either because she did it unilaterally or maybe she was it was indicated to her that she had an opportunity to stay on. So then she therefore withdrew the letter. So, it's still sounds like it's still somewhat of a story that's unfolding here. So be interesting to keep track and see if Ms. Lee remains as the head at the PTO.
It will be interesting to watch that. But for the time being, she remains. So we will keep tabs on that. From a policy standpoint, There is, again, you know, speculation and commentary that her intellectual property positions are not as are very aligned with what Google's might be. So although Google certainly has lots of IP that it protects, it also has lots of IP that it gives away as well. And so, you know, I guess what I'm driving at here is that someone could have been appointed and may yet be who is more strong IP protection friendly than we consider Michelle Lee to be. But again, that's all just sort of spitballing, and it does remain to be seen whether she will remain in this role. But for the time being, that seems to be the case. What else should we discuss?
Well, I think
about
that it
Washington?
Goes without saying that it always pays to be in the graduating Stanford law class with important, influential people. So.
With Peter Thiel, which, yes, this yeah. article points out she was. So, and again, they have no idea whether that had an influence on her being able to stay in the job or not, but it's just an interesting coincidence. Let us move on a bit to the FCC and net neutrality. As Emery has pointed out, we do need to do a more sort of net neutrality deep dive soon, and I don't think this is the day to do that deep dive. However, it's interesting to note that there will be a changing of the guard at the FCC. Tom Wheeler is out, and one of the conservative commissioners is in. What is his name again? Does anybody recall?
Do not. I'm sorry.
Hold on. I can get that real quickly. Amit is his first name. I'm spacing on his last name. There we go. Oh, no. Ajit Pai.
Right.
Is widely seen, not yet specifically appointed, as Tom Wheeler's likely successor as chairman of the FCC. And Tom Wheeler, for his part, does not think that the things that he has accomplished and that the FCC has implemented during the last 8 years are likely to be undone very easily. He has remarked that he met with executives at AT&T recently and doesn't think that the open internet is going to be something that can be toppled with a whole lot of success, at least early on. The courts seem to be in favor of the FCC's authority and what it has done so far. As he says, if there is a reversal of the open internet rule, it will have a high hurdle to vault to prove to the same court why its 2016 decision was wrong. So he seems fairly confident that net neutrality will be with us. I think it will be interesting to see what is considered net neutrality and how it will be enforced as more and more companies, wireless companies in particular, I'm thinking, try and do zero rating and allow certain services to have preferential treatment versus others. Any thoughts on this, Emery?
You know, I wish I could share the optimism that Wheeler has. I'm torn. You know, net neutrality is something that I think has huge public approval and public support for. We've seen, you know, the internet mobilize against efforts to push against net neutrality in the past. So definitely, I think that if there was any opposition, we'd probably see the same groups spin up, you know, try to get support for it, or I guess resistance to it again. But at the other end of the, you know, at the end of the day, we are going to see. You know, the FCC is going to change guard, and the FCC is going to be able to roll back those provisions if they want. So, I don't know. Definitely paying attention to it. We're It's a little hard to be optimistic on today, but I'll try it.
All right. Appreciate that. If anybody's interested in reading more about Tom Wheeler's comments when he addressed AT&T, Eric Gardner has a great piece on it at THR Esquire, the Hollywood Reporter Esquire. His great column over at The Hollywood Reporter. And everything that we've looked at and thought about in preparing for the show today is available to you if you want to head over to tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. This is episode 373. That's where you'll find today's batch of links. Or you can head on over to our Flipboard page as well at flipboard.com/@dhowell. That will lead you to all the magazines I curate on Flipboard. And we have a This Week in Law one that we'd love for you to contribute to as well. So if you'd like to be involved with that, shoot me an email, denise@twit.tv, and I will send you a link to help you help us curate that magazine on Flipboard. All right. So net neutrality, definitely something on people's minds and a story yet being told in Washington, a story that came to a conclusion in Washington as President Obama concluded his term this week. And it's sort of already, for me anyway, fading into obscurity. Even it just happened a couple of days ago, and it's kind of a big deal that formerly Bradley Manning, now Chelsea Manning's sentence was commuted. This person, Bradley, now Chelsea Manning, is a really big deal in the history of WikiLeaks. This was the private who released really the first batch of information that made WikiLeaks what it is today. WikiLeaks existed before this, but the material that was released through Private Manning back in, I think it was 2010, was really the first time people recognized that WikiLeaks was a force to be reckoned with and could mean a lot in the future from then 2010, which it certainly has. So for President Obama to commuted the sentence. So I believe Private Manning has already served something like 7 years. And the reason I keep going back and forth on the name is that Chelsea Manning has transitioned from her former personhood as Private Bradley Manning, and that much of that has happened in prison. So a particularly difficult prison time for this convicted prisoner. And I think all that factored into the decision to commute the sentence. It was a lengthy sentence, and time had already been served. Of course, breaching one's duties as a soldier and duties of loyalty are a big deal. You know, and this person was convicted and was serving time, but apparently the outgoing president thought it was best to say enough is enough on this front. Same did not happen as far as any sort of indicated clemency or leniency for Edward Snowden, which a lot of people were hoping for. But we did get this indication for Private Manning. Wondering, I think we may need to bid adieu to Emery. Emery, are you still with us?
I'm still here right now. I could drop what I'm saying on what I think about Chelsea Manning's commutation. But yeah, I've got to run, unfortunately. Something has just come up that needs my urgent attention. But,
okay, I'm sorry to hear that. I hope everything's okay. If you do want to just give your thoughts on Chelsea Manning, and then we'll see you next week.
Sure, it will be okay, I'm sure. But yeah, I thought this was hugely surprising, and you know, it definitely came out of left field for people that were paying attention. A few weeks ago, it came out that Chelsea was on the short list of people that were to be considered for pardons and commutations. But to be honest, I certainly didn't expect it. I don't think many people did to wake up, I guess, on, was it Tuesday or Wednesday this week, to news that Manning had been commuted and will be released in May. You know, again, you brought up earlier that this we didn't get any pardon from Snowden. I don't think anyone expected that at all. But it is sort of interesting to, you know, compare the two leakers, the two whistleblowers. And, you know, in a lot of ways, I think that you know, Snowden was the textbook ideal example of what a whistleblower should do. You know, curated documents, you know, carefully considered documents that were released to journalists who then, you know, were able to go through them and release documents in a strategic way that, you know, specifically redacted, you know, as much personal information and troop locations, et cetera, as possible. I think it's a lot harder to make any argument that the leaks that Snowden leaked were, you know, damaging. But at the same time, Chelsea, on the other hand, you know, dropped a huge amount of documents to WikiLeaks in 2010. Very important documents that, you know, did show crimes, you know, leading up to the Iraq War, and you know, it showed why and how a Reuters photographer was killed that, you know, was ran counter to the prevailing story at the time. So very, you know, important information. Chelsea was, yeah, given, you know, some say draconian 35-year sentence, longer than any whistleblower had in history, and had served 7 years, some of that done in solitary confinement. As I'm sure everyone's aware, Chelsea transitioned while in prison, which, you know, as I'm sure you can imagine, added to the horrors, I think, of her experience. She had a couple attempts at suicide over the past year. So, you know, you're hearing some people argue that, oh, this is going to set the example and, you know, set a precedent for whistleblowers in the future. And, you know, this was a turning Chelsea into a martyr. I don't think that that argument really bears out if you look at the conditions that she's been in over the past 7 years. And if you look at her experiences over the past 7 years, to put on my cynical hat or my, you know, analytical hat, you know, Chelsea isn't going to be released until May, which means that this one thing that this definitely does is it forces Chelsea to be thrust into a Donald Trump presidency. And this will come back into the narrative and into the public discourse in 5 months when we are again forced to talk about this. And I'm not sure how much of that was a political move or how much of that was necessary for the procedure, but it is something that will come up and it's going to be a topic on Twill, no doubt, right, in May.
Yes. All right. But well, we'll let you run.
Huge congratulations to Chelsea and Chase Strangio and everyone that's been working on her case. I think it's a really good thing for whistleblowers. But yes, I've got to run. I'm sorry to have to do this, listeners and my fellow show members, but I will see you guys next week.
We will miss you. We will see you next week. Good luck. Good luck with everything.
All right.
Take care, Emery.
Thanks. Bye.
So the interesting footnote to the commutation of sentence for Chelsea Manning is it may mean that Julian Assange returns to the United States to face prosecution, etc. You have to wait and see with Julian Assange what he's going to do. But what he said he's going to do is that if Chelsea Manning's sentence were commuted, that he would return. So it will be interesting to see if he stands by that. Indications in the last 24 hours from WikiLeaks and Julian Assange are that he will stand by that. We will just have to see if that happens. But it is an interesting consequence of that decision. Mike, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, like Emery, I was struck by the commutation of Private Manning. I mean, particularly given this particular political environment that we're in right now. I mean, there was so much that we heard about over the last month or so about the Russian hacking and how much they were involved in the presidential and now President Trump briefing on the issue. It was such a focal point of the discussion regarding foreign entities being involved in hacking. And then you juxtapose that with the commutation of the sentence for Private Manning. I just thought it was really interesting. This whole additional wrinkle with Julian Assange potentially returning is also very interesting. I don't know much about what's going on behind the scenes there, but I can't imagine that President Trump is going to be as sympathetic as Obama was. Of course, we don't see these commutations until the end of presidential terms. I mean, this happened in the last few days of the Obama administration. So I don't know if he's looking for some sort of pardon or thinks he's going to get some sort of favorable treatment by this administration, but I can't imagine that would be the case. But who knows?
Right. It's worth mentioning he hasn't been charged with anything in the United States.
Right.
That's not to say that he wouldn't be. And his lawyers have said, here's a quote from one of his attorneys. I've asked the Department of Justice to clarify Mr. Assange's status. I hope it will soon. The Department of Justice should not pursue any charges against Mr. Assange based on his publication of truthful information and should close its criminal investigation of him immediately. We don't know whether they will or not. And certainly, if he came here, I mean, one of the reasons he's been holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London is to escape possible prosecution in the United States and also prosecution in, I believe, the Netherlands for rape charges there. Sweden. Sweden is where he is to be questioned for allegations of rape. So it will be interesting to see if he decides to leave London and come to the U.S. And again, that will be something that we just have to see what happens. Sarah, any thoughts on this?
I think it's an interesting thought experiment to think about what would happen if Assange does come under the Trump administration, because of course, historically, the GOP is, very anti-whistleblowing. And I think I read, I'm trying to remember who, if it was Paul Ryan. I think it was Paul Ryan, bashing the commutation of Chelsea's sentence. But then, at least from Trump's perspective, WikiLeaks was quite helpful, potentially, with his campaign. And so it kind of puts him in an interesting spot. So it would be, I have no idea what would happen, but it's interesting to think about because there's no obvious direction it would go, I think.
Right.
Go
ahead.
Oh, I was gonna switch back to Chelsea. Were you gonna say something?
I was just gonna say, vis-a-vis the new administration and WikiLeaks and the inauguration address that we just heard this morning, which was very, very populist in nature, and the contrast that Emery was drawing between the way in which Edward Snowden leaked information, which was to go to the press and have selected documents examined and leaked, et cetera, as opposed to the various undifferentiated dumps that characterize WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks seems to be a more populist tool that the incoming president has a sketchy or tentative relationship with the press in general. So you might think that a quote-unquote news organization, if that's what we're going to call WikiLeaks, an informational organization that sort of just puts stuff out there and lets people sift through it, might have some appeal to the president-elect, the president. But that's just me, again, speculating. I have no idea. And perhaps from a law and order standpoint, we might get a different perspective coming from the Justice Department. Mike, any thoughts? Yeah.
No, I could definitely see that perspective, but I guess you could look at it from a political perspective too, that, you know, I can't imagine Trump would want to necessarily, although I guess he has in some of his statements aligned himself with WikiLeaks as of late, but yeah, to look favorably upon Assange, it just makes it look, a little too unseemly here that he, and I'm speaking more from a political perspective than anything else. You would think he would want to distance himself, because otherwise it makes it look like he is somewhat in cahoots with Russia and with WikiLeaks. It somewhat bolsters these allegations that have been swirling about recently. So I don't know.
Yep. Yeah, that's an excellent point. Sarah, what were you going to say about Private Manning?
Oh, I was going to say, I think there was a mention in one of the articles at the end about whether or not the Trump administration could reverse the commutation because it will extend into April or May. And they were speculating, or maybe it wasn't speculation. There was a quote saying they didn't think so, that it would probably be irreversible. But it just, I don't know, I can't help but wonder whether, if Trump or people in his administration were so inclined, if they could do something to reverse Obama's decision. Maybe that's just I am in a very cynical stage right now too. So, but that was my thought as I read it. I wonder whether or not it will stick because he's not free yet, or she, I'm sorry, she's not free yet.
Yes. Right. Yep. Well, we'll keep an eye on it and, watch what happens, certainly as to this and as to Mr. Assange as well. Also this week, interesting to note that what would have been, I believe, the largest fine to be proposed or imposed by the FAA against someone who had violated its drone rules was settled for what may be the largest civil penalty for violation of drone flight rules by the promulgated by the FAA, violations by a company named Skypan International, which is a small aerial photography company. The initial fine that was proposed was $1.9 million. Skypan managed to settle that fine and agree to additional fines if it violates FAA rules within the next year. The settlement was for $200,000, and if it messes up, it's going to pay an additional $150,000 in fines. So worth noting that the FAA isn't kidding around about these drone rules. If you're going to take them lightly, you do so at your peril. Any thoughts on this, Mike?
Nothing further.
Nothing further. Sarah?
Same. Yeah. Nothing
yeah.
further.
Well, I think we'll have the last word be from Peter and Friends on Family Guy, which was tweeted to me, I believe, in connection with this story about drone rules and thumbing one's nose at them.
Almost three. I got to get out of here.
What? It's Sunday.
Yeah, the airline's making us all attend a seminar about what to do if someone flies a drone into your flight path.
Yeah, I hear that kind of obnoxious behavior is very big right now in the dangerous idiot community.
Really? I didn't see that in the newsletter this month. Just a big article about how to tailgate a speeding fire truck to get places faster. Wait till I get to the golf course and find out there's no fire.
No, it's a serious problem. Nowadays, any moron could just order a drone online.
Oh.
There's no regulation.
Oh.
And most of them have cameras so people can spy on whoever they want and invade their privacy.
Oh.
Peter, are you ordering a drone right now?
You bet your ass I am. Owning a drone is going to be a blast. Even more fun than when I had breakfast and bread.
All right, so don't take your drone legal advice from Family Guy, because when they say there's no regulation, they're not right. There's lots of regulation. And whether you're having breakfast in bread or not, you're going to need to pay attention to what those rules are. All right, let us move on to really something we've been following for a long time, that had its day in court this week on Wednesday, the Slants case. I should clarify that the Slants case has had several days in court leading up to this. It had a very big day in court on Wednesday before the highest court in our land, the Supreme Court of the United States. We do not have the ruling on that yet, but based on the questions that were asked at the hearing, at the oral argument, it seems to indicate that the justices are skeptical that the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office should be imposing limitations based on whether or not a mark is offensive. I'm sure you've paid good attention and read lots of coverage on this, Mike. Do you agree, as the various columnists seem to, that the court seems to be leaning toward letting the Slants get their trademark?
I do agree. I have been following it closely. I actually read the transcript of the oral argument the day it came out. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that the justices' questions are indicative of the way in which they're leaning, I would totally agree with the assessment that the majority of the judges appear to be skeptical of the government's position in a couple of different ways. There were some questions that came up during the hearing that seemed to trouble a couple of justices. I think Justice Elena Kagan was particularly troubled by – and Justice Roberts too, I believe. They both seemed to be troubled by the notion of how the government – if this was a mark that the government deemed was not disparaging but a positive mark that was in favor of a particular demographic of the country, that the government would not have rejected it. It's only because it was disparaging and potentially hurtful from the government's point of view that the government didn't allow it. And so, as Justice Kagan noted, that sounds like viewpoint discrimination. The government is actively involved in discriminating with respect to what message is being conveyed. So there was certainly that aspect that some of the judges were concerned about. The other aspect that seemed to be troubling to the judges is the whole notion of the government's argument that this is just a government program, and really what this is government speech. We've set up this program by which people can get registrations for their marks, but this is all essentially wrapped or cloaked in government speech as opposed to private speech. And I think that analogy that argument didn't seem to be favorably received by several of the judges, and I think for some pretty good reasons.
What really, and I don't know, I didn't read the transcript of the argument, and I wonder if this even plays a role in what the justices can assess. Mike, maybe you can shed some light for me and our listeners. But what strikes me as something problematic is how inconsistent the USPTO has been over the years about granting marks that I think, would be it's hard to see how you could say that the Slants, an Asian rock / punk band who wants to reclaim this word that's been used as a racial slur or an insult, can't get its trademark, but NWA. Wit Attitudes can get theirs, but then Damon Wayans is rejected when he attempts for clothing. There just seems to be a whole lot of strange inconsistencies in this whole process, and I wonder if that's going to factor in for the court as well.
Yeah, I suspect it probably does. Another example is the Dicks on Bikes mark that was mm-hmm. initially rejected, but then it ultimately was allowed to issue. And it did come up, the inconsistency or the the appearance of inconsistency, depending on who the examiner is, depending on what the evidence is, and so on and so forth. So I think that that is potentially troubling to the government, that if this statutory provision is put back on the books, then you do run that risk of there being some inconsistent application across the board, depending on who the examiner is, depending on what the mark is, depending on a whole host of factors. So that's that is something that that you would think, at least based on some of the questions, is weighing into the calculus in some form or fashion.
I guess we should remind people where this stands procedurally right now. We have a decision that's from the Federal Circuit Court of Appeal that is under review by the Supreme Court. That decision decided on free speech grounds that the government should not be declining trademark registrations on the basis of offensiveness. Is that right, Mike?
You've got it right. The Federal Circuit, there was an initial panel decision by the Federal Circuit that upheld the PTO. That mm-hmm. was reheard by the entire Federal Circuit by nine judges, and they reversed that decision and mm-hmm. found that the statutory provision was unconstitutional. And so now the mm-hmm. Supreme Court is weighing in on that specific issue. We should also mention to our listeners that there's another parallel case kind of wending its way through the court process, as we've discussed before, and that's the case mm-hmm. involving the Washington Redskins. That's a case that's it's raising the identical issue. The Washington Redskins marks were canceled ultimately by the PTO and then a district court, and that decision is being reviewed right now by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. Identical mm-hmm. issues being considered as to whether the statutory provision is unconstitutional. And of course, the lawyers for the Redskins attempted to intervene in the Slants case before the Supreme Court, making the argument or pitching the argument to the court that, you know, only the Redskins can adequately and effectively deal with this particular issue because it is so important. But the court ultimately did not let the Redskins intervene in the case, and the hearing on that Redskins case before the Fourth Circuit has been stayed pending the Supreme Court's decision, because it's obviously going to be dispositive, or most likely is going to be dispositive of the issue in the Redskins case.
So can you foresee a scenario where the Slants win but the Redskins don't?
Well, if the Slants win, that means that the statute presumably is invalid. Mm-hmm. And if that provision of the statute is invalid, then I'm not sure upon which basis you could hold that the Washington Redskins mark is still subject to cancellation. Mm-hmm. I think it, for all intents and purposes, if Simon Tam and the Slants win at the U.S. Supreme Court, I think that ultimately means there's going to be a victory for the Redskins as well.
Right. Sarah, what are your thoughts?
Well, I was just thinking, to me, it benefits the Redskins that they weren't allowed to intervene because mm-hmm. the Slants are such a more sympathetic mm-hmm. case. You know, it looks very different when the marginalized group is using the disparaging term. It can be used as a symbol of empowerment, and, you know, it's a completely different analysis in a lot of ways.
Right.
And so to me, you know, and that's very different from the Washington Redskins situation, where it's a football mascot. So to me, I think, if I were them, I wouldn't have even intervened or even tried to, because the Slants just have a much better, it just looks better and they're more sympathetic. And so, I don't know. Of course the Redskins probably think they have a good argument too, but, for me, it's harder to make the argument, that what the Slants were doing was wrong. I read a really interesting piece. I don't think it was in the show notes, but, by Sarah Zhang, in the New York Times writing about this.
Yes.
And she, as always, had really insightful thoughts about it and made the point that while they are very different scenarios of using these terms. Do we trust, you know, government bureaucrats to be able to, in the form of the USPTO, to be able to kind of see that nuance and, you know, decide when it's an empowering situation and when it's not. And she didn't say that she didn't necessarily, but she kind of made the point that that's something to think about. And I think that that makes a lot of sense, to me at least, that that's kind of a sophisticated social argument. And, you know, will these random, whoever gets the file in the PTO, will they be able to make, you know, make those judgments in a way that is coherent across the board? And I think the answer is probably no, but.
No, they don't. They don't show that they've been very coherent in the past. At the same time, though, I guess there's part of me that's kind of sad that if the court goes the way we think that it's going to go, and the standard that got stricken remains stricken, that it's just a more crass, less civil world that we're headed toward, where registered trademarks are sort of a free for all in offensiveness. That is a little bit troubling as well, but I guess on balance, I'd rather have it be that way than, as you said, Sarah, you know, sort of incoherent, inconsistent application of what's going to pass and what's not, and also trampling on free speech considerations. It's not, I'm not loving either option here.
No, I'm the same. I really don't even, I'm not sure which way I even come out on this. I think it's a really hard situation because, Mike, you mentioned the argument, about it being an element of government speech, kind of, not really working in the Supreme Court, arguments. But to me, that I find that pretty convincing, that there is an element of like an official stamp of approval when you get a registered trademark. And so if you start imagining just like absolutely horrible things that I wouldn't even be willing to say on this show being registered trademarks, that's kind of doesn't sit right with me either. So I don't know.
I agree. I mean, this is it's a very difficult issue. I guess I come out personally in favor of this Lance position, because I do err on the side of thinking that you know, people should have the right to get a trademark registration if they've got a going concern and they've got a mark that they're using in commerce to distinguish their goods or services. They should be able to use that and get the full benefit of federal registration without the federal government placing its stamp of approval on what the message is. I am deeply troubled by the notion that we'll start seeing registrations for swastikas and very offensive, hurtful speech. But that's somewhat tempered by the fact that we are dealing with a registration regime for marks that are used in commerce in association with the sale of goods or services. And if you have a really offensive trademark that you're using, perhaps there will be enough commercial backlash or enough disincentive in the marketplace for you not to use that mark. So I'm hopeful that we're not going to see just a huge deluge of offensive marks that are going to be adopted and used. But, you know, that obviously remains to be seen. But I do feel somewhat a bit of comfort with respect to that. And I'd also mention that, you know, we've got a copyright regime, and this issue actually came up during the argument, which I think is pretty interesting to think about. We have a copyright regime where people can get copyright registrations, a certificate of registration issued by the federal government, and the federal government does not discriminate or does not look at the message that's being conveyed with respect to whatever it is you're registering. So you could register the most vile, inappropriate, hurtful, distasteful content around. You could seek registration for that. And ultimately, I'm not sure that you can get something for obscenity, because obscenity has no protection under the Constitution, as I understand it. So setting aside some of the areas that just aren't protected, you know, but outside of those particular areas at the margin, there's a wide swath of offensive, hurtful, distasteful, terrible things that you could get registered at the Copyright Office, and the Copyright Office wouldn't be allowed to discriminate based on the content of what that work is. And you'd still get the benefit of a federal registration and everything that comes with it. So, you know, that was that was brought up pretty heavily at the argument this week. But that's really a federal program as well, and it wouldn't be appropriate for the Copyright Office to censure or not allow registration of offensive material. Why is it appropriate for the Trademark Office? Pretty compelling argument.
It is a really compelling argument, and I guess it kind of jibes with what you were saying earlier too. That then it's kind of up to the marketplace. As to, you know, if you're trying to make a commercial endeavor out of your offensive material that you've registered with the Copyright Office, who's going to sell it? You know, who's going to stand behind it and say, yeah, we're a marketplace for that kind of material? So I think that would translate over as well. And certainly there are marketplaces for offensive material, but they're not going to be terribly mainstream. You know, it's going to be a niche. It's going to be a niche marketplace and not Walmart, presumably. Though one never knows. Commerce is king in our country, so it will be interesting to see how this goes. I think we're going to make Bad Marks, Good Law our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We put these phrases into the show in case you are a lawyer or other professional and you like to listen to or watch our shows and also get credit in your field. If you're a lawyer and you want more information about that, we do have a chart up at wiki.twit.tv. If you find the page there for This Week in Law, we've got a chart of all the 50 jurisdictions where lawyers in the United States might need to be making their MCLE compliance and how we might make that process easier for you. We'll put a second phrase in the show. Some jurisdictions like proof that you have actually watched or listened, and this is how we help you out in that regard. Before we leave the topic of the Slants case, I thought it was at least worth mentioning that David Peskovitz has a post at Boing Boing this week about a restaurant lease in Canada, in Vancouver, British Columbia, that seems to be suffering from a species of the same problem. The restaurant is called Moby Dick's, and the restaurant has been denied its lease because, quote unquote, the word dick in Moby Dick was an offensive term, and that the sign would hurt the value of neighboring properties and the restaurant would bring increased litter and violate city laws on odor. I don't know. This one seems like pretty much of a stretch on calling something called Moby Dick's offensive, but there you go. Again, you could see how Moby Dick's trying to register its trademark could trigger a similar kind of analysis and controversy to what we've been discussing. I am guessing in the United States, Mike, that there are several things that are probably many, many things that have Moby Dick as part of their trademark, setting aside any other intellectual property concerns such as copyright.
I would imagine that's true. And to draw a contrast between the Moby Dick's dispute and the Slants, as it came up in the Slants argument, nobody is telling the Slants, or Simon Tam rather, that he can't call his band name the Slants. That's not the issue. It's simply just a registration issue. Whereas with Moby Dick's, this building council, presumably a government actor or an agency of the government up there in Canada, is saying you actually can't use this, or you can't, I guess, lease the restaurant space with that name. So that truly is trying to affect somebody's ability to use a particular or express a particular idea in commerce. So I don't think anything like that would ever happen here in the U.S. And if it ever did, I think there'd be a great argument that that's just clearly a violation of the First Amendment for any state, city, or federal government to impose such a ban.
Right. Well, as long as we are already living down under the sea, talking about Moby Dick, I think you better take us to Bikini Bottom, Mike, and tell us what's going on with SpongeBob and the Krusty Krab.
I'll happily do that. So, yes. Lest readers think I only blog about and focus on cartoons and other things.
Let him tell you otherwise. Of course, that's all he blogs about.
Well, it is one particular area I look for IP lessons, and in fact, this case involving SpongeBob is a good one. It deals with trademark protection for fictional places. For those of our listeners that may not be familiar with SpongeBob, SpongeBob is this animation series that's been playing on the Nickelodeon Channel going back to the 1990s. And Bikini Bottom is the fictional place where SpongeBob and his cast of characters get into all sorts of trouble and mischief. There is a restaurant called the Krusty Krab. It's one of the watering holes or greasy spoons there in Bikini Bottom. And it's a fictional place, obviously. There's no such place here on dry land where the Krusty Krab restaurant is operating. So an enterprising company decided back in 2014 or 2015, decided they wanted to open a restaurant here on dry land called the Krusty Krab. And Nickelodeon, who owns a series of copyrights and trademarks associated with the SpongeBob series, was not happy about that and sued under various legal theories, including a trademark infringement theory that, hey, company, you can't open the Krusty Krab restaurant because people will associate that with the SpongeBob series and with Nickelodeon. They'll think that we are somehow authorizing or sponsoring or approving of that particular business. So ultimately, there was a lawsuit that was filed over the Krusty Krab restaurant and the application that was filed by this company. They moved for summary judgment. And Nickelodeon did, and ultimately got it. And the court said that there was no right for this company to use the Krusty Krab restaurant name because it is a staple from the series SpongeBob. Consumers are likely to know of and be familiar with this fictional restaurant down under. And even though Nickelodeon has never opened a restaurant with the name Krusty Krab and served Krabby Patties or other fare, that did not preclude Nickelodeon from claiming trademark rights associated with the name. So
right, that's the really interesting twist to this case, I think, is that as you write, Viacom doesn't have a trademark registration for Krusty Krab with a K, and certainly doesn't have one in the area of commerce involved here. As you said, they don't operate Krusty Krab restaurants. So the fact that the court was able to protect it anyway, I found pretty interesting.
Yeah, and that was essentially the defendant's argument that, look, we only have trademark rights associated with actual use in commerce of that mark on the goods or services that you're trying to protect. And Viacom, I think I said Nickelodeon before, but Viacom has not actually operated a restaurant. So on the surface, it's not a bad argument. But when you drill down and look a little deeper, you know, the court really had no trouble finding that, well, people will still – it's such an iconic place, and consumers for the last 15, 20 years have come to know the Krusty Krab associated with this series on Nickelodeon. People are going to think that there is a connection or affiliation or association between these two companies. So
Sorry, I was just wondering if just the name was involved or if logos were involved too.
That I don't know. The Krusty Krab, the word mark, I know there was an application that was submitted to the Patent and Trademark Office. And I think it actually – I could be wrong on this. I think it actually went through. It was initially approved, I believe. But then ultimately that's going to be stopped here by this court decision, assuming it's upheld – assuming there is an appeal, I assume it will ultimately be upheld. So
right, and then you point out that there were other cases where Kryptonite and Daily Planet were tried to be appropriated and used for purposes in the real world outside of the Superman universe, and that didn't fly because they were quote unquote staples of the Superman character and story.
Exactly. So that same rationale applies here to the Krusty Krab. It's a staple of the SpongeBob series. Millions and millions of people are familiar with it. There's not only been the series, but there's been two feature films featuring the Krusty Krab restaurant. So there you go. Trademark protection for fictional places. It's a good lesson and an interesting one.
Right. Sarah, would you go have lunch at the Krusty Krab if it were around the corner from you in the real world?
I probably would, and I wouldn't even know that – I would not know the reference, I have to admit.
No. Just
my
when
son
I was
probably
gonna,
would, but
– Yes.
I was going to say that to me there's something a little bit troubling about the thought that you can kind of extend copyright protection in this way. That's one way of looking at it, right? It's, obviously copyrighted works can then find ways of having perpetual protection over particular elements within your story. On the other hand, I was convinced, Mike, by your piece. I didn't realize actually that you wrote it until we started talking, but as I read it, I was like, yeah, that makes sense. Especially, I mean, to me, it all comes down to the confusion issue. I guess I don't know that I am 100% certain, but it seems at least possible that for people unlike me who know the reference might actually think that the restaurant was affiliated with Viacom. On the other, I mean, I can also see if you said to me that they wouldn't be confused, I could also be persuaded because they might associate or it might trigger in their minds, oh, SpongeBob, that's funny. I don't know that they would necessarily think that that Viacom owned the restaurant actually. But to me that's what it all comes down to, right? Is whether or not people would actually be confused about the source of the restaurant.
You're exactly right. And there was, as I think I mentioned in the piece, there was consumer survey evidence that was presented by Viacom showing that I want to say about 30% of the respondents that were surveyed believed that it came from Viacom. Now, most likely, the survey didn't ask if people associate this with Viacom. What people probably said in the survey answers is that they associate it with SpongeBob or the makers of SpongeBob. People wouldn't necessarily associate it with Viacom itself. Rather, they associate the name Krusty Krab with a single source, i.e. the producers of the SpongeBob series.
Interesting.
Sarah raises a good point about copyright, Mike. How was this not a copyright infringement case by Viacom, since it's really the character of the Krusty Krab restaurant that they own?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, we've talked before about the Batmobile case that that there was copyright protection associated with the Batmobile, the Ninth Circuit told us a year or so ago. I suspect that maybe the copyright aspect wasn't as involved here, if at all, because we really are just dealing with the name of the restaurant and not necessarily the physical attributes of it.
Right.
And copyright doesn't protect names and titles. That would really fall to it within the domain of trademarks.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. And the way that the whole thing got teed up was the fact that a service mark application was filed by the people who wanted to operate a real world Krusty Krab restaurant. So it sort of came into being in the real world in the trademark arena, and Viacom's probable first priority was to make sure that that trademark didn't fly. Sarah, did you have final thoughts about Krabby Patties or anything else?
The only thing I was going to say in response to Mike was, to me, the way that the survey was worded would be really interesting. That would have been the thing I really honed in on, if I were the whoever owned the restaurant here. Because if it's just a matter of, do you associate the phrase Krusty Krab with SpongeBob? Like, that's not really the trademark question. Hopefully it was more specific that, would you think that this Krusty Krab restaurant was officially associated with the people that created SpongeBob or something to that effect? Obviously they wouldn't have to know that Viacom owned SpongeBob as a property, but making the connection that there would be actual confusion about who owned the restaurant, not just the fact that they understand that the reference came from there, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. How the survey would typically be worded, it wouldn't actually ask consumers to associate the name of the restaurant with SpongeBob in the survey question. That would be considered a very leading question and creating biased results. What would typically happen is you would design the survey question to say, do you associate or affiliate this restaurant name with another company? And if people say yes, then you ask a follow-up question, which company or companies, and you'd probably get a variety of different answers, many of which are going to be, the SpongeBob people, or the company that makes SpongeBob, or something to that effect. And from that, you can extrapolate that people associate it with a single source, i.e. the SpongeBob people.
Oh, I love this. Beatmaster points out in IRC that deaf beer has become a real thing, even though it started out as a fictional beer in The Simpsons.
Oh, yeah, great point. Yeah.
I'm pulling up the Wikipedia page. Started as a fictional beverage on The Simpsons. Since then, it has become a real brand of beer in a number of countries without permission or consent from its original creator, Matt Groening, and has resulted in legal battles with varying results. An official version of the beer is sold in three variations near the Simpsons ride at Universal Studios. So interesting that the rights holder actually decided to sell the real thing too. So thank you, Beatmaster. Mm-hmm. Also, great quote, just to get really deep and geeky on us here, from Reverb Mike and IRC. Harkening back to Logan's Run, fish, plankton, sea greens, and protein from the sea. Since we're on the topic. Now everybody has their throwback movie to go back and review this evening if they're looking for Friday night entertainment. In a moment, we're going to get to another fun trademark dispute that we've discussed on the show before, but before we get to that, I'd like to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, one of my favorite services in the world, Audible. Audible is something that I have enjoyed since the late 90s when I first started doing long commutes in the car, and it's really become the way that I enjoy literature and nonfiction and pretty much everything else I would otherwise read if it's not on the web. Audible is just a fabulous, fabulous way to enjoy all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. And if you're not already a loyal Audible listener, and I have the feeling many, many of you are, you're in luck because you get to try it out and get a free audiobook just by following the instructions I'm about to give you in a moment here. And if you're looking for a good book to download and try out the service, like I said, my Audible library is just vast. So I'm pulling out for you the two most recent things that I've enjoyed on Audible right now. I'm in the middle of Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Vance, and also narrated by J.D. Vance. Really, really powerful and strangely funny. I did not expect this story to be as humorous as it is, but it is a story of a young man who grew up partially in Kentucky, partially in southern Ohio, raised by quote-unquote hillbillies, white working-class Americans. Really, really touching portrayal of his grandparents in particular. I am just completely in love with his grandmother as he writes about her, because even though his grandparents came from a completely different part of the country and were more armed and dangerous than mine might have been, it really resonates with me. My Sicilian grandparents had a lot in common with J.D. Vance's Kentucky and Ohio-based grandparents when it comes to fierceness and loyalty and all the rest. So really, really great story, well told, with a lot of insight and, as I said, humor. So I definitely recommend that one. And then the second to last thing that I read and downloaded from Audible, much more to read here, but I read the short story Sunny's Blues by James Baldwin in the compilation of short stories called Going to Meet the Man, tales of Harlem and city life, and all written in the 50s. Great insights into the jazz era in Harlem. And in particular, Sonny's Blues has a literary description of music and what it is to play music and experience music like nothing else I've ever read in my life. It's so good. Definitely check that out if you've not already. So a couple of good suggestions there. Emery was also going to toss in, he told me before the show, another thing that I loved listening to on Audible was Neil Gaiman's American Gods, which is done in sort of ensemble cast style. And Emery is listening to that one right now. I can definitely also endorse that one as a great listen. If you're not yet an Audible customer, you can get, and you're in the US and Canada, this offer applies to all listeners in the US and Canada. You can download any of these books for free or another one of your choice by going to audible.com/twill. That's audible.com/twill. Thank you so much, Audible, for your support of This Week in Law and the TWIT Network as a whole. Okay, what were we going to move on to? We were going to move on to Louis Vuitton and the dismissal of a case involving my other bag. Do you want to tell us about this, Mike?
Sure. So this is a case that was recently handed down by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, affirming a decision of the, I believe it was the Southern District of New York, that found that a parody of a very famous Louis Vuitton handbag was protected and was not an act of trademark infringement or trademark dilution. So we might have the visual up here on the screen, but You've got this canvas-looking bag with, on one side, you've got the what appears to be a replica or a close replica of the Louis Vuitton, their brown leather purse or handbag. On the other side of the canvas bag, you've got the text, "My Other Bag." And I guess the humor associated with this is they're using the Louis Vuitton bag to, I guess, poke fun at high society and have it replicated on this canvas bag, a kind of an ordinary everyday bag that just about everybody uses.
Right.
And so they're kind of poking fun or making fun. Yeah.
You've got a piece of crap car and you've got a license plate frame that says my other car is a Mercedes, that kind of thing.
Exactly. It's a takeoff on that exact sentiment. So So Louis Vuitton has been involved in a couple, well, several of these cases over the years, and seems to come up on the short side frequently. This is the latest installment. There was a prior case involving Louis Vuitton where they were not happy about some doggy toys that were named Chewy Vuitton. And they ultimately came up short in that case too. So this is another one. I think the courts, at least in the Second Circuit, take somewhat of a dim view of Louis Vuitton's arguments here. And essentially the courts are saying, hey, look, this is a joke. You need to get over it. Everybody will associate this with being humorous and a joke. So don't be so touchy, Louis Vuitton, mm-hmm. I think is the court's messages are. So, mm-hmm. I, as a trademark lawyer and trademark litigator, I'm a little bit troubled by the court's decision, frankly. I mean, I guess I guess it's funny to some people, but at the same time, you know, the court's saying, look, consumers are obviously going to think this is a joke. I'm not so certain that that's true, though. I mean, you've got on the one side, you've got a copy of the Louis Vuitton handbag, and then you've got on the other side, my other bag. I guess consumers would only think it's funny if they are presented with both sides. They see the Louis Vuitton replica, and then they see the my other bag, and they think, oh, okay. Oh, and this is on canvas. I get it. They're trying to make fun of Louis Vuitton in some way. Ha, ha, ha. You know, if that's really what's going on in the marketplace, then that it seems to be a pretty good argument. But at the end of the day, I'm not certain that that's necessarily what's going on in the marketplace here. It's completely realistic to me that a consumer that's using this canvas bag would be walking down the street and passersby are just going to see the Louis Vuitton and think, oh, that's an odd looking Louis Vuitton, or, oh, that's kind of a new take on the Louis Vuitton logo or something like that. And right. We have no clue that there's my other bag on the other side. We'd never be able to put two and two together here. So,
but does that matter?
I'm a little troubled by it.
Those aren't the consumers you're worried about, though, being confused. It's the ones who are actually making the purchase, right? Because that's what you're worried about. The consumer confusion you're worried about is that people would be buying it thinking that it was a Louis Vuitton bag, and nobody's going to do that because they're going to see both sides of it when they purchase the bag. So the fact that somebody walking down the street might think that if they saw it, if they were holding it, you know, in a way where you couldn't see the other side, that they thought it was a real LV bag, I don't know that that matters to the trademark question. I'm not a trademark lawyer.
It's kind of a stretch, but I could see someone being confused and maybe thinking, oh, that this was a joke or ad even being carried out by Louis Vuitton. I could see their lawyers making this argument that someone could walk into a shop, see this and think, oh, Louis Vuitton is selling this bag to encourage people to buy the real thing. You know, of course, you'd want your other bag to be, I don't know. I don't know. I'm going to, I think, probably retract this and say, no, nobody's going to think that.
Sherry, you raise a really interesting question. And the Lanham Act, which is our federal statute that protects against trademark infringement and also trademark dilution, which I think is important in this case, it protects against what's called point of sale confusion, which is exactly what you're pointing out. A consumer walks into a store and sees it on the shelf and thinks, oh, I'm not confused. This is obviously a joke. But then you've got what's called post-sale confusion, which is consumers that see the product on the street or elsewhere, and they are confused into thinking, oh, that's a new Louis Vuitton bag, or that's a they're getting into the canvas bag business, and so that's a different type of potential consumer that whose impressions matter from a trademark infringement analysis perspective. And the other thing I'd point out is, when it comes to trademark dilution, dilution is really a separate species of a wrong when it comes to trademarks. Dilution protects against the whittling away of a famous Mark's ability to only attract a particular reaction from a customer. It's probably a bad way to say that, but essentially dilution is protects famous marks and protects owners of famous marks from other people using them, because famous marks kind of have a very heightened status of protection under our trademark laws. So from a dilution perspective, if I see that bag going down the street, Louis Vuitton can say, look, you're no – this is a famous mark. Allowing this third party to use it means that we are kind of robbed of protecting our specific image and portraying that to the consumers in the way that we want. Now this other company can do it and kind of whittle away at the goodwill associated with our famous brand.
So Louis Vuitton has to protect its trademark in various ways, and this is not the first time it's been in court over something humorous. You want to remind us what happened with the Chewy Vuitton case?
Yes. Yeah, so Chewy Vuitton, as I'd mentioned, was a doggy toy case where a third party came up with, and I think it wasn't just Louis Vuitton, it was other types of play on some famous marks, Louis Vuitton being one of them. And Louis Vuitton sued, saying that this would be, you know, trademark infringement and trademark dilution to allow a third party to use our mark or a colorable imitation of our mark in this way. And the court ultimately said, nope, that's protected parody. So yes, there's a good example of it on the screen there.
Right. So the parody argument didn't come up here with My Other Bag?
No, it did. That's exactly what the court did here. It is a parody case.
Yeah.
Similar rationale and reasoning that was used by the My Other Bag court, just like the Chewy Vuitton case.
Gotcha. All right. We are going to move on and talk about one of our favorite topics, the Axanar case, and in particular, the Klingon language as it comes up in the Axanar case. So we don't actually have a court doing any sort of analysis about the copyrightability of Klingon or, you know, any sort of legal ruling on that. But there is a slight move by the court. What we have is a tentative ruling on motions in limine, which are the pretrial motions that determine what sort of evidence can be introduced at trial in the case by CBS and Paramount against Axanar, which is headed for trial very shortly. And the one of the motions in limine specifically asked that CBS and Paramount not be able to introduce evidence that copyright infringement occurred would occur if Axanar were to release its film from use of the Klingon language in the film. And tentatively, the court has granted that motion. So it seems as though planting their flag on ownership of the Klingon language is not going to help CBS and Paramount in this case. So this is I think just an interesting thing to mention, given the fact that we've talked about the copyrightability or lack thereof of Klingon in the Axanar context a number of times on the show, and have had Mark Randazza out, who worked with the Language Creation Society. That's the entity that has been briefing this issue as an amicus, a friend of the court, in the CBS Paramount versus Axanar case. Mark's been on the show discussing the brief that he wrote, the Klingon that he used in the brief that he wrote, and once again, the motion in limine that has been tentatively granted here contained some fun Klingon phrases as well. We use Klingon here to make a point. They say, as well, we have not sought nor do we need any permission from Paramount for our use of Klingon, not even when we have created a new Klingon name for Paramount itself, which they have then written out in Klingon, and I believe translates to never surrender success. So interesting development that ownership of Klingon just won't be a factor in that case. Mike, are you – well, once again, we should explain procedurally – we don't have a final ruling on that from the trial court. What happens is the court will look at the motions that have been filed and tell people how it is inclined to rule. And what it has said is, yeah, I'm inclined to keep that evidence out. So there's still briefing that could happen and the court could change its mind. But that's what we know so far. Mike, any thoughts about this?
Well, if that ultimately ends up being the decision of the court, I think it's the right decision. I mean, we're talking about language. It's so even though it's a, you know, quote unquote made up language, it's a language that has the ability to express ideas and communicate. And therefore, it really isn't subject to copyright protection, or at least it shouldn't be. You contrast the language itself with how you go about using that language and how you go about expressing particular ideas. The expression itself is copyrightable, but the mode and the means and the method by which you communicate that expression, that shouldn't be subject to copyright protection. Copyright protection is specifically excluded for such things as processes. And it seems to me that a language itself fits comfortably within that definition. So hopefully Judge Klausner will make that a final ruling. And if it's ultimately appealed, it'll be upheld by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. It's the right decision.
Yeah. Sarah, you agree?
I don't know if I'm just playing devil's advocate because this is I'm surprising myself, but I guess I'm not as convinced of that. Just thinking about, I mean, one thing that came to mind was the Harry Potter case from however many years ago that was, the encyclopedia that they sued over. It's not a language, but it's similar in the sense of they were characters and features that were from this fictional world. The very good counter argument is that those then become facts. You know, they cross the line into being something that people in the public are going to refer to. And it certainly seems like you can make that argument here. But I guess, so to me, it wasn't completely cut and dried. I think I like that result. I like the idea that the language would not be copyrightable, but I wouldn't have been surprised, I guess, if the court went the other way. That's what I should say.
Right. Well, maybe what we'll see from Paramount in response to this tentative ruling is an argument along the lines of what we were discussing earlier on the show about the Krusty Krab. You know, it's a system as has been argued, but it's also a character. You know, the Klingon language is a part of the world of Star Trek. Right. And it exists in that world as a character. It exists beyond that world because others have developed it and brought it out in a way that CBS and Paramount never did. I mean, I think really CBS and Paramount has an argument that they've made up a few words in Klingon, that the language itself is entirely a product of, its grammar and syntax and everything else is a product of the very passionate fan base that decided to make it a usable language. But still, as far as the parallels to what we were discussing before, it kind of exists as a character in that universe, and I could see them making that argument. You agree, Mike?
Yeah.
Boy, that's a really interesting point. Because I see some parallels with our Krusty Krab discussion. You know, Klingon is this fictional language. It's obviously very closely associated with the Star Trek movie series and what have you. So, but I think what we're talking about here ultimately at the end of the day is you know, they're, yeah, although they are creating a commercial product, I don't know. You raise a good question. Is the Krusty Krab doctrine alive and well here? I don't know.
Right. I don't know.
One thing I wanted to mention in response to Sarah's very good point about the Harry Potter case, I think you might be referring to the case where there was a Harry Potter dictionary that was created by a very ardent fan of the Harry Potter series. And what this individual did, as I recall, it's been a while since I've looked at that case, but I think what he or she did was put together this compendium of facts and trivia questions and other things that that evoked or invoked the Harry Potter movie series, you know, would have a series of questions and other things. And ultimately what the court said there was, look, this is – you're essentially creating a derivative work based on the movie series, and a derivative work is one of those rights that's protected exclusively for the author.
Right.
Whereas I think the distinction here is you're really talking about a mode or method or process of communication, and that in and of itself isn't a work of authorship. So I think that's probably the distinction that would be made here. But you do raise an interesting point about does that Harry Potter case potentially factor in here?
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think at the end of the day, probably the larger case that this is a part of will be similar to the Harry Potter case. And then the Seinfeld case is another one that comes to mind, that that was the one where they did the trivia of situations in Seinfeld. I can't remember the name of the case. I can never remember case names, but it's the same idea.
Same idea, exactly.
Yeah. And I imagine that's what will happen with this mockumentary. But I have no idea. I haven't followed the case very closely, but it seems like that's the direction it's heading.
So I thought this was a super interesting point that was raised by one of our listeners to me on Twitter, Reg Hunt, Reg P Hunt 3 on Twitter. Raised the fact that an entire language was created, well, actually, the beginnings of a language were created for the movie Arrival, which I haven't seen yet. So I don't want to spoil it for myself too much or any of you. I understand it's a phenomenal film and it's all about linguistics and language and communication. But apparently, without spoiling too much, and you can turn it off if you don't want to know anything about the movie, but apparently linguistically in the movie, something was created for the film called a logogram that is a means of communicating with the alien intelligence in the movie. And it's a new language created out of these logograms. There's a great article on Wired about this called How Arrival's Designers Crafted a Mesmerizing Alien Alphabet. Excuse me, it's an alphabet, not a language. So what's written there is some of the logograms have translations, but the creators of the logogram say it would be possible to build out a larger vocabulary. The designs and tools are in place. All that's missing is the will and a lot of patience. So if fans of the Arrival movie are as zealous as fans of Star Trek are, we could see another new language bloom out of that alphabet and then have intellectual property discussions about who owns that language. So I thought that was really interesting. Thank you, Reg, for pointing that out. Let's conclude the show with some interesting developments in the world of constitutional law, crime, and punishment. All right. Firstly, we like to let you know when there are developments related to unlocking and being compelled to unlock one's phone, either with a passphrase or a fingerprint. There was a recent case in Minnesota, an appellate court in Minnesota, which is its second round of review. This case could go to the Supreme Court of Minnesota eventually. if there's an appeal there. But so far as things stand, there was a suspect suspected of burglary and a couple of other lesser charges. Law enforcement wanted access to the suspect's phone in order to find evidence to aid in conviction. The court ordered the suspect to provide fingerprints or provide basically the application of his finger to the phone to obtain that evidence. And all of that was upheld by the Court of Appeal because, quote unquote, according to the court, producing his fingerprint to unlock the cell phone did not require a testimonial communication, and thus the order did not violate the suspect's Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination. So, again, this is past phrases and past codes have been found by other courts to be entitled to Fifth Amendment protection. This is another instance of the fingerprint being analyzed differently. Mike, any surprises here for you?
No, this seemed like the right result. I agree with the court's rationale that I don't see what the difference would be here between a blood sample or being forced to provide a voice exemplar or anything like that. It seems to me to be on all fours with the decisions that have upheld that as not being testimonial evidence.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, any thoughts?
Well, I guess the fact that you can't, that they can't compel you to put in your password, which has the exact same function, seems kind of crazy. When I mentioned it to my husband last night, when I was reading the article, he said he had read already that, a rule of thumb, if you're ever going to be arrested, apparently is reboot your phone because they can't compel you to, because then it requires a passcode in addition to your fingerprint. So if you have anything on your phone, but to me, it kind of points out that's kind of crazy that matters. That the fact, you know, they have the exact same function of unlocking your phone, but if it's fingerprint, it's okay for them to force you to. If it's typing in four numbers or however many numbers, it's not okay. But
yeah, that does seem a bit contrived, and it does seem to be, you know, for people who just want to thwart law enforcement and are smart and do things like listen to our show, they might know the distinction and do the things that they need to do to prevent access. So it does seem like sort of an artificial distinction, but the distinction exists. Many, many courts have found that the one thing is protected and the other is not. So we remain in that world as of this Minnesota case that was resolved this last Tuesday. Couple of other interesting, I think this one is just so good and it's almost worthy of being our tip of the week. Although I think Sarah just gave another tip of the week to our more nefarious listeners and viewers. This is by a law professor named Adam McLeod, and he teaches at Faulkner University's Thomas Good Jones School of Law. And he did a fascinating experiment using his own legal predicament in constitutional law and did it, I think, so that he could write this article and point out this constitutional loophole involving traffic cams. And what he basically did was decide, he got a ticket. It was issued by a traffic camera, and he decided to fight it. Like, you know, sometimes law professors and lawyers will do just because they have the know-how and the time. But here, Professor McLeod also had a point to make. And the point that he wanted to make was that we've bought off societally on the fact that if a traffic camera is going to convict you for a violation, there's no actual evidence other than what the camera recorded of your crime. There's no one present when the crime takes place that can come into court and testify that you did it. There's no photographic evidence of the driver. There are no witnesses, and et cetera. So, and I believe there was an additional wrinkle in this one that the car was not actually being driven by Adam McLeod. So let's see. It said he got a traffic camera ticket. It said that he'd committed a particular traffic violation on a certain date, a certain time and location. It showed a photograph of one of our family vehicles, but not the driver. And it charged him with a civil violation of criminal law. And this is the weird loophole that he wanted to point out, that when you're being accused of a civil violation of criminal law, you aren't entitled to the ordinary due process you would get under the Constitution. And that's how these traffic camera things are able to survive. So to make his constitutional point, he went into court, he cross-examined the officer who was designated to come down, the officer who had signed the affidavit saying, yes, there was a traffic violation here, and got him to admit that he was not present at the time of the violation, that there was no photographic evidence of the driver, there were no witnesses, and that he did not know where the alleged violator was at the time of the violation. So then he asked, so you signed an affidavit under the pains of penalty of perjury alleging probable cause to believe that I, Adam McLeod, committed a violation of traffic laws without any evidence that that was so? And the officer answered yes. So in other words, the officer admitted in court committing perjury. Defendant, the author of this article, asked that the charges against him be dismissed, or the civil violation against him be dismissed. And the judge granted it because the officer had just admitted perjury. So in that way, that's the way in which this is a tip of the week. It's also a really interesting deep dive into how traffic cameras sort of live in this weird due process gray area that might be a bigger problem for municipalities if more people were to treat them and treat the violations that they're tagged with by a traffic camera the way this law professor did. Mike, did you find this as interesting as I did?
I did. I loved it. It was a great article, great story. I actually had a very similar experience. My niece borrowed our car once and had the exact same thing happen. And, you know, I wasn't nearly as enterprising as this law professor was. We, you know, we just paid the ticket and moved on. But, you know, if it happens again, I'm going to dust off this article for some pointers on what to do.
That's right. Sarah, what do you think? You too?
Yeah, I thought it was fascinating and actually quite chilling because at the end, it kind of makes this larger point about how these little ways of eroding our due process rights have consequences when they add up. And to me, it was kind of like a moment of, wow, yeah, he makes a cheeky headline. And, when I read the headline, I was like, oh, this is going to be silly. But by the end of it, I was like, wow, this is actually really important. I think that's a good tip of the week to read the entire post, because it really does make, I think, a larger important argument.
Yep. Do recommend that people do that. It's a very interesting story. And in fact, it sort of goes into catch 22 territory procedurally as he's trying to get this dismissed and his appeal bond back and all of the rest. And as he wrote the piece, none of that had been resolved yet. Finally, again, on the constitutional due process front, there's a very fascinating piece in the Washington Post about Best Buy technicians, Geek Squad members, and I'm sure this probably applies to others, but you know, Best Buy and the Geek Squad are pretty ubiquitous throughout the country. And it turns out it came out in a case against a California doctor facing federal charges after his hard drive was flagged by a Geek Squad technician, that apparently the FBI has confidential sources within the Geek Squad. And some of them, or actually here, according to a judge's order in the case, all of them mentioned had received some kind of payment. So they're acting as agents, arguably, for the federal government. But nobody thinks when they bring their computer into Best Buy for a repair that they're handing it over to an agent of the federal government for search. So that is the issue here. Best Buy, for its part, was quick to come out and say that any circumstances in which an employee received payment from the FBI is the result of extremely poor individual judgment, is not something we tolerate, and is certainly not a part of our normal business behavior. And court records in the case did not show how often or how much the technicians were paid, other than one $500 payment to one supervisor. But you can imagine how many Best Buy technicians both would love to, you know, catch the terrible child pornography, that feel they're doing a good deed by catching folks that are amassing bad stuff on their computers and making a little money on the side from the FBI. Sounds like a great deal as well. So even though Best Buy has said, no, we don't condone this, it's not hard to imagine it happening in a pretty regular way, an issue that I hadn't considered before. How about you, Mike?
No, I hadn't considered it before either, but it makes, frankly, total sense. I mean, I don't know. I mean, if you're engaged in illegal activity, particularly, distribution of child pornography, you know, you would think the last thing you'd do is turn your computer over to a third party at the Geek Squad or anywhere else for that matter. You would think that you would safeguard that and not let anybody have access to it. So it doesn't seem to me to be that big of a stretch that if I turn my computer over and I literally have illegal material on there, that could wend its way to law enforcement somehow. So,
yeah. Oh, but I unlike you, I think it probably happens all the time where someone has a problem with their computer and they just don't think about what's on there. And perhaps it gets flagged by someone at Best Buy or elsewhere. Sarah, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it probably happens all the time too. And in this particular case, it sounded like the child porn was in some part of the computer that was incredibly hard to get to. You had to have, I forget what exactly they had to do to get to it, but it wasn't like it was just sitting there on the desktop or something.
Right.
But I also think that this is another kind of chilling story to me, because while obviously no one's sympathetic to people with child porn on their computers, you can imagine things that are illegal that relate to or are considered illegal related, you know, for activists or things like that. And that's kind of a scary thought, you know, thinking about this administration we're entering into. If the FBI can use, can do things by using Best Buy that they aren't allowed to do under the Constitution, that seems highly disturbing in order to violate people's privacy. So that's another way of looking at it. I think in some ways it's kind of a disturbing trend, if it really is a trend. Like you said, it wasn't clear from the article how often this happens, but certainly I would find it quite problematic if there's a systematic effort by the FBI to get on people's computers in ways that they would not be able to do themselves by using these agents of, you know, through Best Buy or any other organization. So I don't know. I see it as problematic.
Yeah. And while I'm certainly comforted by the fact that Best Buy came out and quickly said, we don't condone this. And, you know, I mean, you sort of extrapolate from their comment that employees who did this and accepted money for information would be fired. It's one thing to say it and it's another thing to stand behind that. So I wonder how much follow through there is or will be, what sort of internal investigation will follow. from this. Some sort of investigation, I hope, would. All right. On a far, far, far lighter note, we bring you our animal selfie of the week, which involves nothing more exotic than the family dog, but it's a good one. It's pretty wet here right now, but in the summertime, you might see this guy right down here on the beach.
I'm sorry about that, folks. So Denise had a power outage. So thankfully it happened at the end of the show. So I think we'll just call it a day from here. We want to thank Sarah for being with us today. Sarah, thank you. It was great to have you. Great insight, great discussion. And I think we all are better off for you being with us today. So thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. It was lots of fun to be back and nice to meet you.
Yeah. Likewise. So I think that's going to do it for us today. We appreciate everybody tuning in, and we will look forward to seeing you all next week, same time, same channel. Thanks very much.